This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Beyond the Tipping Point.
A physicist, a leading expert on clean energy and climate, he was an advisor in the Clinton administration. His book, Hell and High Water, becomes too true daily. Time magazine called him the web's most influential climate change blogger. Dr. Joseph Rome's Climate Progress is the only blog right on my browser toolbar. It is indispensable. Joe Rome, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for your hard work. Let's dive right in. Despite our efforts, science seems to show humanity progressing towards a difficult, even calamitous future. I'd like to get your reaction to the report from the British Royal Society, that theme issue, Beyond 4 Degrees.
Yeah, that's a pretty alarming issue. I will say that many of us have, for quite some time, been saying that climate scientists need to start looking at what happens if humanity doesn't take any action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Scientists, I think, quite rightly had expected humanity would take action by now. So they've mostly been modeling sort of here's what happens if you take action. But people should understand the worst case scenario, and that is that the planet warms 7 degrees Fahrenheit or more this century. And the consequences are quite dramatic. I think everybody in the glaciology community believes that sea levels would rise 3, 4, maybe 5 feet, and then keep rising. I think that there's an understanding that you're going to get more extreme weather. I mean, we've only warmed about a degree Fahrenheit in the past 50 years. And we're already seeing extreme weather in places like Nashville and Moscow and Pakistan. So when you warm 7 times that much or 8 times as much, you're going to see a lot more extreme weather. And I think one of the points that the there's sort of two key points that the issue makes, one of which is that, you know, in the worst case scenario, this amount of warming could come considerably earlier than most people realized. It could come as early as the 2060s. That's not likely to happen, but people need to think hard about it. The second thing is that we often focus on sort of how much humans are going to respond to this, and of course humans are very adaptable, but most species, you know, they're not as adaptable. And so entire ecosystems could easily collapse. And of course, humans do rely on ecosystems for much of their food. I mean, a very good example of what could happen is what might happen to oceans and acidification, which is a loss, a significant amount of the food chain in oceans. And I'm thinking of specifically marine life, coral reefs, you know, which are the home to much of the biodiversity in the ocean. Phytoplankton, it turns out, we've lost about 40% of phytoplankton in the last 50 years, and they are the cornerstone of the entire marine food chain. So the oceans are getting hotter, more acidic, we're overfishing them. There's a grave risk of a mass extinction of marine life.
Well, let's look a little bit at the political responses. You know, the Canadian government is now kind of the bad guy. We try to stop international action on carbon emissions. Our government muzzles climate scientists. You know, we just had a thing where we called off the scientific research program into climate damage in our vast Arctic, and instead we're going to lease the climate research ship to the oil companies to find more oil in the melting Arctic. We can't get much lower, Joe, but how about your country? Do you expect more denial or maybe even investigations of climate scientists?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It looks like North America is going in the wrong direction. Unfortunately, in the most recent November election, we Americans put a lot of people who deny basic climate science and who oppose clean energy action into Congress. And so I think the prospects of any serious action by the United States over the next couple of years are pretty minuscule.
And it doesn't look like China's doing much. We hear a lot about clean energy projects there, but their coal use has quadrupled from the figures I'm reading, so I'm not seeing a lot of hope there either.
Yeah, China has become kind of the best of times and the worst of times. They keep building coal plants and as such have become the world's biggest emitter of heat-trapping greenhouse gases. On the other hand, they you know, they, I just posted today on Climate Progress that they are going to add 500 gigawatts of new renewable power by 2020. So they are going to be, they're going to be both the dirtiest and the cleanest country in the world. It's kind of weird in that regard.
Could go either way. What is your take on the climate negotiations in Cancun, Mexico?
Yeah, they're going on now. They've been going on for a week. I think the prospects of a major deal are quite limited now because, you know, the United States can't deliver on its commitment. There was a meeting a year ago. Every year is another conference of parties. And there was one in Copenhagen where Obama, people may remember, came in and negotiated at the last minute a very high-level deal with other leaders. And it was very impressive, but it required the U.S. to deliver on a 17% emissions reduction by 2020, and that would require, almost certainly require, a legislation that's not going to occur. So the U.S. isn't prepared to act. Obviously, many other countries have been questioning this, including, you know, Canada seems very unlikely to act also. We have to face the realistic prospect that all that you're going to see is sort of more bite-sized activity. And by bite-sized, I mean we're only going to see limited agreements in things like forestry, in perhaps some deals around money to support international adaptation. Now, the good news is a lot of businesses have come to Cancun, and they are prepared to put money into action. So I think you're going to see action in this country at the state level. A lot of states, like big states, California just elected Jerry Brown, who's a very aggressive supporter of clean energy. New York State just elected Andrew Cuomo, who's a very big supporter of clean energy. So unfortunately, we're not going to see the kind of national action that we need, but I think you're going to see a lot of individual players step forward, and you're going to see remarkable and steady advances in clean energy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm happy to have Joe Rome as our guest. Yesterday, Joe, a friend picked me up in his car. It was very comfortable, and like most people, I was well-fed. I thought to myself, this easy life will just go on until it can't. So what's wrong with keeping it all going as long as we can?
Well, you know, that's on Climate Progress, I called that, you know, this is the global Ponzi scheme, where we keep basically living off the future wealth of our children. You know, it can't keep going on forever. I think it's clear that, well, you know, one can certainly have a certain amount of denial, but the reality is that we're not making any more oil, so peak oil is coming. And the only reason oil prices aren't at record levels is because we're in a global economic slowdown. But oil prices are going to go back up, and I think you're going to see things like food prices go back up as commodity prices go back up. And then on top of that, the reality of climate change, I think, is becoming more and more obvious to everybody. So there's no question that I think sometime, maybe not in this decade, but by the 2020s, you are going to get, I think, kind of desperate to reduce emissions, and the world is going to change at that point. I mean, I think, obviously, the climate is changing. I mean, that, Canada experienced dramatic climate change this year, including at the Olympics, where they had to airlift in snow. You know, the Arctic is warming up faster than anywhere else on the planet. We had a fifth of Pakistan was flooded. You know, Moscow had to was hit with a once in a thousand year heat wave, drought leading to wildfires. They stopped all grain exports for the year. And like I said, this is just from about 1 degree Fahrenheit warming in recent decades. So inaction doesn't stop climate change. And like what I often say is, we are going to change into a clean energy economy. There is no escaping that fact because, A, we're not making more fossil fuels, and, B, the consequences of inaction will become sort of more and more palpable. The only question is whether we do it voluntarily and do it in time to avert, you know, the kind of catastrophic impacts that are laid out in that Royal Society special issue, or whether we do it, you know, kind of after the fact, and we suffer the consequences of serious global warming.
Well, we've all seen the flooding in Pakistan on the TV and China, but very few people seem to know that Ecuador just proclaimed a national emergency due to an extreme rainfall event, and Venezuela is struggling with flooding right now. I think this is one of the underreported stories of climate change, extreme precipitation events. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the extreme precipitation events get reported. It's just that no one explains the very basics of it, which I, you know, have tried to do on Climate Progress, interviewing people like Kevin Trenberth, the head of climate analysis for the National Center for Atmospheric Research, who makes clear this is a very basic prediction of climate science. As you heat up the planet, you put more water vapor into the atmosphere, and that water vapor gets swept into these large superstorms and then gets dumped as more extreme rain events. So in this country, Nashville got a once-in-a-thousand-year rainstorm. Many cities, as you say, have been just totally swamped by the staggering amounts of flooding. So yes, there's no question, for the foreseeable future, the biggest impact on most people of the warming planet is going to be these extreme deluges and downpours.
Joe, you're at the center of a whirlpool of climate information, and some of it makes my jaw drop. Much of it is frightening or upsetting. What sort of stories keep you up at night?
Well, I'm very concerned about the oceans, because I think, you know, we're basically clear-cutting the oceans, but because they're underwater, nobody sees them. We peaked in fish harvesting globally over a decade ago. So there are a lot of people who are very concerned that we are passing the carrying capacity of the planet. Now, rich countries, the U.S. and Canada, we have a lot of money, and I think Americans and Canadians are going to suffer along with everyone else. We're just more well off, so we'll be able to deal with it better. There are billions of people around the planet, particularly by the middle of the century, who are just going to be in places like Bangladesh, where seas are just displacing their homes, to places in India and China, which rely on the glacier melt from the Himalayas, which is going to drastically diminish. They rely on that water, sub-Saharan Africa. There's a whole article in the Royal Society paper on the impact on agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa of climate change. So, you know, what keeps me up is the science is clear. Humans are warming the planet. The climate is changing just as people, scientists predicted decades ago. It's going to get much worse if we don't take action soon. And the most frustrating thing to me is, because I worked at the U.S. Department of Energy for 5 years, is that we have the technologies. We still need to keep doing research and development to improve technologies for the next generation, but we need to start deploying the energy efficiency technologies, the solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, at a much faster rate than we are now. The technology is there. It's really the political will, unfortunately, that is lacking.
So you think we could still power a worthwhile civilization without fossil fuels and without going back to the Middle Ages?
Well, I think there's no question about it. I mean, I think people need to understand we don't have to go to zero emissions tomorrow. We just need to steadily reduce our emissions over the next, let's say, 3 or 4 decades. I'm not saying, I never say that it would be easy, but it definitely would be straightforward. Many independent analysts, including the International Energy Agency, have explained that the cost is literally just 2 or 3% of global economic wealth. But that cost doesn't disappear. It just goes into, instead of investing that money into dirty, polluting, inefficient forms of energy and infrastructure, you put it in clean, efficient forms of infrastructure. That's what gets you on the path to reducing the heat-trapping greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel combustion. So it would take a lot of effort. But, you know, like I said, we are definitely going to be doing it. I mean, during the lifetime of most of your listeners, I don't have any doubt that we are going to make this transition. It's just if we start the transition aggressively now, we could really avert the worst impacts of climate change. If we dawdle for another 10 to 15 years, we're going to place such a tremendous burden on our children that we may cross tipping points that simply you can't cross back from.
Could you tell our listeners the best ways to approach and use your blog at climateprogress.org?
Well, I have tried to set it up so that it can be a place where people track I think people need to become educated on this issue. If they care about the future, if they have children, I think it's important. I think their kids are going to live in a changed world and are going to want to understand these issues and indeed be trained in key areas like clean energy, because that's going to be one of the big growth areas in jobs in the coming years. I've set it up so that I follow the news regularly. I blog on clean energy. I blog on climate science. I blog on politics. I try to cover international things. I try to write on Canada. In fact, I recently had a contest, what would Canada look like in 2050? So I try to keep it lively that way. I try to have some humor because this is a tough subject. The blog has been highly recognized. Time magazine recently named it one of the top 15 blogs in the entire country on any subject. If you go to the site in the right-hand column, I have a list of sort of introductory posts to key issues like economics and solutions, and I have some key science posts listed. So it's a good site to get up to speed on the key issues and then to follow the subject.
How long have you been doing it?
I have been doing this for a little over 4 years now, and it has become read by, I have 36,000 subscribers to my feed, and another 15,000 or so people who show up every day to read the posts. So it's very rewarding. There are a lot of people out there who want to stay on top of this issue. And the other key thing is I have a great community of commenters. People often remark that about, I try very hard to keep out the people who spread disinformation, keep them off of the comments. And as a result, I have a lot of scientists and leading environmentalists who comment on the blogs. And so some posts will have 50 to 100 comments in which people will explain, just sort of give their opinion, what they're doing locally. And so it's kind of a community of sort of climate hawks is the big term, by the way, that David Roberts had a little contest. What should people call themselves who care about, you know, climate and clean energy? And everyone seems to like the term climate hawk. So the climate hawks come to climateprogress.org to follow this issue.
Well, it's true. I've had a little education on various climate issues, not just from your blog posting, which always has lots of links that head off to the original science or statements, but also from the comments. There's lots of good stuff in there. As we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add, something important that we've missed or a message to leave with us?
I think people do need to become informed and take action. What that form of that action, I actually had a little query to my readers over the weekend. What should you ask people to do? I think the first thing is become informed on the subject. I think it's worthwhile to try to green your home. You'll find that it can save you a lot of money, and it's not going to change the world, but it's the kind of thing that allows you to, A, when you talk to your neighbors, explain, hey, I did it. It's not that hard. We all can do it. This is an important subject. But I think the key thing is become informed and sort of find your own little niche here. But ignoring the problem is not going to make it go away and is not a solution.
You have been listening to Dr. Joseph Rome on Radio EcoShock. He's the author of Hell and High Water, Global Warming, The Solution in the Politics and What We Should Do. And he's definitely the world's best climate blogger in these momentous times. Joe, thank you for sharing your time and insight.
Hey, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is EcoShock Radio. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
The Royal Society in Britain, the country's most prestigious institute of science, has issued a new series of papers on our climate prospects. The theme is 4 degrees and beyond. Official scientific circles, including some government advisors, now seem to almost admit mistakes were made, but they're saying climate scientists underestimated the sensitivity of our ecosystem. You may not yet have been told the severity of the changes to the atmosphere and the oceans that we triggered with fossil power. David Wasdell told us that years ago. I couldn't believe it then. Now I do. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thank you for your welcome.
Everyone was talking about 2 degrees of warming as the upper limit we could have. Now diplomats at Cancun say even that target is no longer possible. Can we survive 4 degrees and beyond?
This is a very timely question, Alex, because it's a two-edged sword. Many of the scientists and published papers over the last 3 or 4 years have been indicating that even 2 degrees is quite a dangerous level to go to. And in the papers that you've been mentioned that have just come out from the Royal Society's journal, it's been made very clear that 2 degrees is not the threshold of dangerous warming, but the boundary between dangerous warming and extremely dangerous warming. So we have to put that as part of the context of where we're going. But back to your question itself, can we survive 4? Is 2 degrees possible to achieve? The papers that you describe from the Royal Society are saying with the current sets of promises and the current outputs of greenhouse gases, the likelihood of being able to hold a temperature increase to only 2 degrees, even though that is the boundary of extremely dangerous change, is very small indeed. A conference here held in Oxford University about 15 months ago, on which these papers are based, looked at the probability of temperatures reaching 4 degrees globally, 4 degrees increase, that is, on the pre-industrial level. And that is, it's survivable in the sense that life will go on, humanity in some form would survive, but the impacts of that and the consequences of it almost don't bear thinking about. The other thing that is absolutely crucial here is that the promises made for the Copenhagen Accord do not in any sense give a foundation for achieving the 2 degrees. They don't even give us a foundation for achieving the 4 degrees. They're way off target even for that. And judging by the way Cancun is going at the moment, and we're right in the middle of it, it doesn't even look as if those promises themselves will either hold or be implemented. So we're facing a massive, massive problem at a global scale.
You've also told us that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, was not good enough. What sort of institution do we need?
It's a difficult question again. You don't know how old Google is. The IPCC is the most extraordinarily complex and competent bringing together of science around a particular problem that the world has ever masterminded and put together. To say it's not good enough is a very difficult value judgment. I don't think I've ever actually said that. What I have pointed out is that the papers that they review in putting together their 4 yearly reports have to be in the published domain, they have to be peer-reviewed, and that means there's a delay between publishing material and it's getting into the IPCC documents of about 2 years. And then when you think that it takes 18 months for the Intergovernmental Panel to produce its report, having gone through its assembly process, so that when it comes out, it's already perhaps 3 years behind the leading edge of published material. And to get to the published material in the first place, the scientists and the researchers have done their work, assembled the data, put it into written form, had it peer-reviewed, pushed it around, come back, edited it, polished it, sent it out for peer review again, and then got it published. So by the time we see, you know, the summary for policymakers from the Intergovernmental Panel, the material it's based on can be 5 or 6 years behind the leading edge. And that's a real worry. So I don't say it's not good enough. It is an extraordinarily competent foundation of science. It just isn't moving fast enough. And I think what the Royal Society's Philosophical Transactions Special Edition, which is the one you refer to, has done is brought that time delay down by about 4 years. So this is leading-edge stuff. It's a year old. There's a delay in getting the material together. But even that isn't right on the button. So somehow we need an institution that creates real-time, leading-edge climate science and its implications and applications right up to date. And that needs to be available for policymakers, decision-makers around the world. What that looks like, everybody's scratching their heads about, but that's what we need.
But I think that, you know, to try and come up with a group that's going to get a consensus approval by even the greatest oil exporters like Saudi Arabia, and that's going to be a problem. There's been a call that the IPCC should not be have any activism to it. We need some sort of command center. We need some sort of group that's on the job full time, paying out scientists all the time, getting some action to save us. Does that relate to your idea of Apollo Gaia?
Oh, boy. Where do we start with that one, Alex? First of all, you're moving to a command center, an application center, rather than just the information center. The IPCC is an information organization. There's no way that it has any input even to policy statements, let alone to action. Secondly, the constraints on action that we're meeting in the world at the moment are phenomenal. Let me go parallel and sidestep you a little bit. If you have a massive population addicted to heroin, and then there's a major movement to deal with this as a massive social problem, you do not give power to those who produce heroin, who profit from it, who push it, the drug barons, if you like, and the mafia, who take massive economic kickback from the addiction. If you put those into positions of power to manage the detox program for the group, they will get nowhere because there are huge vested interests in maintaining the addiction. That's very similar to the situation we're in. There are major corporations, nation states, national economies, international procedures, pension funds, the whole fossil fuel industry, the electricity generating industries, the coal producers. To name just a few, we could add in, of course, aviation, transport, automobile industries, and all the investments that depend on them. All of these see that effective action to limit the use of fossil energy would be like killing the goose that lays the golden egg. And they will mobilize goose protection procedures for all they are worth, and they have done so to huge effect, to block action on climate change that would undermine the profitability of managing the addiction. So what you're raising raises the whole issue of the dynamics of action in a world that is caught going two ways. One, a sustainable planet demand that lives within the boundaries of a viable ecosystem. If you like, our life support system is under threat. We need to solve that problem. The other one, the survivability, if you like, the sustainability of the profitability of using fossil energy. And those two are at war. And that war has immobilized the United Nations procedural processes. It immobilized Copenhagen. It is at this very moment, as we speak, immobilizing Cancun. I don't think a command center can be put together with teeth to implement a control and command program at a global level.
Very good. Well, let's get back to the science then. I saw your presentation to scientists at Talberg, Sweden in 2008. David, I came away with a lot of worry and a few new understandings. To start with, you say it's a mistake to look at temperatures only as a way of judging where we stand now in global heating. Can you explain?
Yes, that's right. I said this back in 2005, in fact, in my approach that was taken up by the Club of Rome way back then. Temperature change is a consequence of climate change. The causal thing is the new heating being applied to the Earth's surface. So if you like, it's about energy. You could have a very large room with a huge kettle of ice in the middle, and you can start pouring energy into the room, heat into the room. But the room temperature doesn't change very much with the initial heating. It takes a lot of energy to melt the ice and do other things, and then the temperature begins to respond. Earth's even more massive and inert than that. So what we're looking at is the amount of energy per square meter that we're taking up at the Earth's surface because of the greenhouse effect, the fact that we're blocking energy going back out into space and therefore trapping more of the sun's energy close to the surface. That amount of energy is changing things in the Earth. It's melting ice. It's changing ocean currents. It's changing all sorts of processes in the climate, one of which is temperature. Now, we can monitor temperature, and we've been doing that, and we can see it going up quite fast and then going down a bit and then going level for a bit and then going up again and then down again. The overall trend is upwards, but there's a lot of variability in it. And over the last 4, 5, 8 years, I suppose, the rate of change of temperature has been fairly low because a lot of the energy has been going on into ice melt. We've seen a lot of change in the ice fields in the Arctic and the Antarctic. It's gone into evaporation. There's a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere. It's more moist and humid. And the energy has also gone down in terms of heating the deep ocean, which is where a lot of the energy goes. So global heating continues unabated. The temperature goes through sort of wiggles. And if your temperature at the moment is anything like the anomaly that's happening here in Western Europe, and I think I'm right in saying you've got a very cold spell coming down the western coast of Canada and into the western coast of the U.S. at the moment, people are saying, global warming, you have to be joking. But in fact, the other side of the world, the sea temperatures around Manila and the Philippines are about 10 degrees above what they should be, as are the sea temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico. And you get these shifts in local conditions, which you cannot use really to generalize about climate change. But the temperature profile, I feel like a secondary sign, a signal among many of what's going on in the energy equations of planet Earth. I hope that's not too technical.
Not at all. I really understand that. As I take it, the first burst of heating, let's say, gets soaked up into these various sinks and processes, whether it's melting ice or warming the oceans. That could take a while, but eventually when those break, then we may see a lot of more heating on the land. Did I get that right?
Well, we are already seeing some heating on the land that is quite detectable. And in certain areas, because a lot of the heat energy gets pushed towards the poles, for instance, the temperature over Greenland and around that area was about 4 or 5 degrees above what it is expected to be this last year. We had heat anomalies over northern Canada and into Alaska. We had heat anomalies over northern Russia and Siberia. And so the big land masses are showing heating of 3, 4 degrees in their polar areas, even though the average temperature increase for the Earth as a whole is only 0.8 of a degree. The critical thing to focus on is that the energy going into heating the Earth and changing the climate is inexorably going on, whatever the temperature is doing at the moment. So don't let people tell you temperature change is slowing down. There's no problem left. The problem is going on, whatever the temperature is doing.
Let's move to a second fundamental point that you make clear. There are a number of forces called positive feedbacks which multiply the impact of our human-made greenhouse gas emissions. Can you tell us how this works and why it matters so much? And please, take as long as you like.
How long is as long as I like? It's a huge subject. When I started work on this just over 5 years ago, we recognized that the effect of what we call feedbacks was, if you like, the greatest known unknown that we were struggling with. And the impact of that determined really what was going to be faced as the crisis for the future decades. My background is in what we call systems analysis, not necessarily in climate change, but we shifted application to this area and began looking at feedback processes. I think most of you who are listening to this will have been in a public hall or situation where the PA system has been turned up too sensitive and, you know, it's gone into that scream and you go, you put your hands over your ears, oh no, and where's the technician? Go and turn that thing down a bit. That's feedback, where the signal that comes out of the loudspeakers, the output stuff, gets picked up on the input side of the microphones and fed back through the amplifier and out through the loudspeakers and into the microphone and out through the amplifier and builds up until it reaches a feedback threshold and very uncomfortable. Well, the climate system is like that, except that there's about 40 identified feedback mechanisms in global climate. What we have done is put out a signal, if you like, that's our greenhouse gases and the heating that stems from that. That begins to change things at a planetary level. Temperature starts to rise a little bit. As the temperature goes up, the water vapor in the atmosphere increases. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. That increases the greenhouse effect, which changes the rate of heating, which pushes the temperature up more, which evaporates more water, which increases the greenhouse effect. You got the idea? And there are many such feedback mechanisms that I could go into. For instance, we know now quite well that the amount of sea ice in the Arctic area is decreasing in summer, year by year. It went down to an extraordinary low in 2007. 2010 was just about the same record level. And on a trend pattern over decades, it is decreasing quite rapidly. Now, that's an effect of heating. But what it does, it decreases the amount of white surface in that area of the world during the summer period. So we have dark, open water, which absorbs sunlight and sun's energy and heat and warms up. And that increases, therefore, the absorption of energy in the Earth system. It decreases the reflectivity of the planet. And that means that the amount of heating goes up, which, of course, melts more ice, which means there's more open water, so the heating goes up. And that's another, what we call an albedo positive feedback. Have a look at the Teilberg presentation, which I think you're giving a link to on your website as a result of this interview.
Yes,
because
indeed.
Because I do go into quite a lot of detail about feedbacks in that.
Well, one thing I got from that was that these feedbacks may well pile up on each other so that if we think, well, we'll just double our fossil emissions into the atmosphere, we may in fact find that natural reaction to that could multiply it not by a factor of two, but by a factor of four or more. Is that correct?
Yes, and we get into areas of huge uncertainty, but about the precise quantities, because we've never been there before. But the process is pretty clear. Let me give you another for instance then. One of the issues that we look at is that the great tropical forests like the Amazon rainforest, at some stage in this development of higher temperatures and drying out of that area, begins to break down and change from tropical forest into savanna. Now, that's a difficult process. That's tree death, it's burn, it's forest fires going out of control across vast areas. That's a huge, huge release of carbon dioxide from the burning and the degrade of a huge forest area. And that adds to our human emissions from the use of fossil energy and increases the rate of global heating. The same, I think, you're experiencing in Canada with the spread of the bark beetle through the coniferous forests moving up towards the tundra. And as the temperature warms, the larvae of the bark beetle are not dying out over winter. And that is racing through your coniferous forests like the plague. And those trees then start to die back. There is burn back, there is decay. And we get the northern forests going through a carbon output as well. That adds into the problem. Now, you may want to ask me more about the tundra release and what we call the methane release. Would that be interesting?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with David Wastel, director of the Meridian Program in England. His lecture series, Beyond the Tipping Point, has rippled already through the expert world. Now it's going mainstream. We should talk, I think, about the methane briefly, and then I'd like to get on to your idea of tipping points.
Okay, let's try and take this briefly. In the far north of the major continents, that's northern Canada and Alaska, and in northern Russia into Siberia, there are vast areas of frozen land, the tundra with permafrost. And as the temperature goes up and the heating to the Earth focuses, much of that energy is transported to these areas faster than at any other place in the world. And that means that these areas of permafrost are beginning to melt in the summer and melt further each summer. And one of the consequences of that is that microbial activity begins to rot the frozen vegetation that's been held in the cold store, and that starts to release carbon dioxide. And another byproduct of that is methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And there are deposits of methane held deeply frozen in the tundra, which begin to be released. We're seeing that happening already. There are lakes developing on the surface of the tundra with methane bubbling up, and you can actually catch it and set fire to it. There's about three times as much carbon stored in the tundra deposits as we have already put up from burning fossil fuel. So as that goes, there's a huge cauldron or deposit, potentially, of further carbon dioxide and methane, which could be released into the atmosphere and is already starting to do so. And then the really big one is that under some of the shallow seas, there are vast deposits of methane in a frozen crystal lattice form, which we call clathrates or methane hydrates. And they're held in place under the temperature of the ocean depth and the pressure of the ocean depth and the temperature at which they are. And they're protected as well with ice over that surface of the ocean in many places. Now, the ice melts, the water warms, there is warmer runoff from the northern coastlines of the continental areas. The sea starts to warm, the sea mixes down to the bed, and it starts to release methane bubbling up from the seabed. It starts to break through the fossil ice that has stayed there since the last ice age, that is trapping fossil deposits of methane even deeper in, and those are beginning to come up through the rotting and permeable frozen layers of the ocean bed. And scientists are watching this very carefully because that is a feedback. Because the methane is released into the atmosphere, that increases the greenhouse effect, that increases the temperature, that increases the heating, that mixes down to the ocean floor, that sets off more methane, that releases... You get the idea? And that is potentially the biggest but long-term feedback that can push the temperature almost out of control. Very worrying.
Yes.
But you're talking about tipping points.
Yes, well, you know, James Hansen has said there's many tipping points, but you have said there may be a kind of master tipping point, a point that if we cross it, the result will be catastrophic climate change. What do you mean by that?
I'm glad you raised that question because there's quite a lot of misunderstanding about tipping points. Let me give you one or two quick examples. I've already mentioned the tipping point in the Amazon rainforest between an established forested area and tipping across into the development of a savanna area with a huge shift. That's a threshold point at which, as the temperature globally reaches a certain level, a particular factor like the sustainability of the tropical forest shifts into a new behavior. And once you've passed that threshold, there's pretty well nothing you can do to stop that shift happening. It can be quite dramatic and fast. Another one would be the melting of the Greenland ice cap. Now, we're already seeing significant ice loss of about 300 cubic kilometers per annum net release of ice from Greenland. And I've got a feeling I may have got a zero wrong there. It could be more than that. But let's just take it on the principle. As the temperature increases, we reach a point where the Greenland ice cap itself begins to be non-sustainable. It starts surface melt. Water goes down to the base of the ice, that lubricates it, it starts to move down to the glacier valleys, it discharges to the sea, it melts in the ocean. And once that process starts, it feeds on itself, because there is then more fresh water in the ocean, there is greater feedback around the edges of that ice cap, the level of ice starts to go down, the further it goes down, the warmer it gets, because it's warmer at lower altitudes, so it melts faster. And you move into this new zone of not just a sustainable ice cap, but a collapsing ice cap. That's a tipping point. And John Schellenhuber and Jim Hansen's been involved, and Tim Lenton and many other scientists have pinned about 9 of these critical tipping points, like the Gulf Stream that brings so much energy across the Atlantic to Western Europe. If that starts to falter, and there are conditions that make it do so, that would be a tipping point. Because Northern Europe will then become much colder, but the Gulf area will become much hotter. And remember, that's where all the tropical storms and the hurricanes get their energy from and lash into the east coast of the States. Those are what I call subsystem tipping points. They're thresholds at which particular phenomena change from one state to another. Now, if you look at the Earth as a whole, it looks very clear now that there is a critical threshold, a tipping point, if you will, between a state of the Earth in response to climate change that just goes up fairly slowly and reaches a new, hotter level, an equilibrium, as they call it. And the threshold is between behavior that reaches an equilibrium, it may be 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees hotter than it is now, and that's catastrophic. But if this threshold is crossed, then it moves not to a new equilibrium, but to a self-amplifying runaway behavior. And where that stops at the moment is anybody's guess. But it is a whole new ballgame of looking at the future climate. In my Tailberg lecture, I specify the criteria for that. I look at the implications of it. And I make some assertions about what I saw then as the fact that we had crossed that threshold and had already started on the pathway of runaway behavior. And I'm very thankful that there was a mistake in that analysis, and we found it and put it right. The threshold was not as close as we thought it was, and we probably have not yet crossed it. But it's there as a threat in the future, and the processes that we have already put in motion make it look to me as if we are in a fairly severe risk of triggering the runaway behavior in the Earth system and crossing that total global tipping point. We don't want to go there. We have to be able to intervene early enough to make certain that that does not happen.
perhaps that's a good point for me to ask about the possibility of any happy ending. I don't see a good outcome for our big surge in fossil fuels, but you did offer one last vision of hope. Can you share that with us?
You know, people always look for hope when faced by something that feels impossible to cope with, don't they? Whether it's illness or whatever it is. And I think there's realistic hope and there's illusory hope. And there's despair. Despair can be realistic despair. Despair can also be illusory. What I don't see at the moment is any hope at all of the global political and economic and intergovernmental negotiating process achieving an action intervention that can solve the problem in the time frame required with any realistic outcome of a survivable planet for humanity as we know it. And I have to live with that reality. I don't think it's despair. I don't think it's gloom and doom. I think it is the reality we face. Secondly, the sensitivity of the Earth system, how it amplifies the signal we have put in, the CO2 we've emitted, has been grossly underestimated in current science. That underestimate underlies all the targets being set in Cancun or not being set in Cancun. It looks as though there's an error of about 2.5 times the effect of the dynamics of climate change. It's far worse than we thought it was going to be. I think that's reality, and that, again, is not to be despaired at, but it creates a sense of eco-shock that is profound. Now, hope. At the end of my Telberg presentation, I used the image of the shift from a supertanker to a shoal. And do you remember that? You saw that presentation, I think.
I do. And for listeners, by a shoal, you're talking about like a shoal of fish, for example.
A shoal of fish, that's right.
Yeah.
It's so dynamic and it moves almost incredibly synchronously through the water, particularly when it's under threat. But if you think Copenhagen and the economic processes, the political processes, are like some massive supertanker that is hugely inert, controlled by a tiny power elite, fueled, if you like, by fossil energy and the profits from it, and is going absolutely in the opposite direction with enormous inertia and power. But those institutions are put there by human beings, little decisions from millions and millions of people over time. We construct the supertanker. And I think the time is coming to deconstruct the supertanker, for each and every one of us to take personal responsibility, institutional responsibility, whatever our area of responsibility is. It may be individual, it's a home, it's a local community, it's a small organization, and we can work together in such a way that we take on board the reality of the crisis and develop what we call a phase change in human behavior that shifts from the command and control failures to a living, learning, moving system of humanity responding in a crisis in short time scales and at a level that actually makes a huge difference. That, I think, is a sign of hope in the social process. And I think we need to be paying much, much more attention to that as a way forward as we face the despair of the criticality of the reality we face and the failure of our political institutions to deal with it.
So there may still be the possibility of a mass shift among the people rather than in their upper institutions. We could still hope that like those fish or the birds that you see in the sky that suddenly know it's time to turn one way and head another, that could still happen for us here on Earth.
I think that's probably the only realistic hope we face, Alex.
Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up?
Yeah, I think I could bring you a story. I like stories. Do you remember the Apollo space program?
Yes.
I'm sure you do, and Apollo 11 and the landing on the moon. I think half the world was glued to the television when that first small step for humanity was taken. Big one for humankind. That was Apollo 11. Do you remember Apollo 13, two launches later?
Vaguely.
Okay, and Tom Hanks did a reconstructed movie on this one, which other people will have seen. Apollo 13 was launched and went off very smoothly, running by the book, and then there was this catastrophic explosion in one of the oxygen tanks, and it blew off half of the coating of the module and so on. And we had that laconic comment, you know, Houston, we have a problem. And Houston Command Center went into Oh, I don't think that's possible. It must be a computer glitch. And for 15 minutes, they treated it as nothing in space had happened. They were just trying to solve the computer problems back up. And then all the signals began to come in from the monitors to say, actually, we've just pretty well lost the propulsion systems, the life support systems on this module. It really is a catastrophe. Well, we've taken 15 years to not recognize that planet Earth, we have a problem. We've blown a hole in our life support system. And I think what happened on Apollo 13, if you like, is a parable for our time. They had to abort the mission, the achievements, the goals, the wishes, the hopes, if you like, of going around the moon and doing another moon landing and all that. And they shifted the mission, like that switch in the path of a crowd of birds or a swarm of bees or a shoal of fish. And they started to move in a different direction. Survival was the agenda. Close down power systems. Find ways of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere of the module. Find ways of supporting each other with the food and the water that they needed for the long return journey. Keep each other alive if they possibly could, so they didn't lose anybody on the way back. Not knowing whether there was damage to the heat shield, whether they could in fact achieve a re-entry, even if they got it right. Loss of correction and computer systems, having to do a manual course direction just before re-entry. And they made it. Now, I think Apollo 13 is a parable for the planet. It's no longer a tiny module out in space. We are the module. Planet Earth, we have a problem. There's no Houston. There's no rescue. We are also Houston. So maybe humanity, in the spirit of response to a collective crisis, can mobilize a collective response that puts survival, not exploitation of each other, to protect our own personal interests or national interests or group interests and let the weak go to the wall, but a collective survival movement that solves the problem in the time frame we have. I offer you Apollo 13 as a parable for tomorrow's world.
And there you have it. He has presented the awful facts and fears of climate science to major conferences across the world. David Wastel is the international coordinator of the Meridian Program and director of the Apollo Gaia Project. You can find out more about that at apollo-gaia.org. All the links you might need for this are in my Radio EcoShock show blog for this week at ecoshock.info, including a recording of that Thalberg speech. Listen and learn, please. David, it has been an honor to talk with you.
It's been a pleasure.
Living in the seats of your pants.
We've just heard an in-depth interview with David Wastel. You may object that David is not a full-blown climate scientist. True. But he is certainly plugged into climate science and highly regarded by some of the world's best. I'm going to give you a load of links from the best climate science so you can check Wastel's claims for yourself. Here is just one cross-check. At an international climate conference called 4 Degrees and Beyond, held at Oxford, UK, Dr. Richard Betts, a climate modeler from the government-funded Hadley Center, delivered a speech which backs up most of the points you just heard made by David Wastel in our interview. You can download that speech by Richard Betts and others from that key presentation with a link from our show blog at ecoshock.info. These talks were the basis of the recent released papers by the Royal Society. I'll quickly summarize a little from the Betts presentation. He explains that our current greenhouse gas emissions are at the high range of projections made by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, in their 2007 report. As the West refuses to cut emissions, nothing going on in North America, as we've heard, and as Asia joins the fossil-powered civilization, we are headed for the worst predictions. The most widely studied IPCC projection for medium emissions takes us to 4 degrees Celsius of average global warming by 2090. Most scientists consider that disaster. Even higher variations suggested by our current emission path were not studied deeply at all, being considered too extreme to happen. Since 2007, however, the UK Hadley Center, among others, began to look at what would happen if we failed to control our pollution of the sky. First of all, understand that an average global warming of 4 degrees centigrade will not be evenly distributed around the world. Some places, especially the Arctic, will get much, much hotter, perhaps 6 or 7 degrees C warmer within this century. Precipitation, Richard Betts explains, will also change greatly. The Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Amazon will dry out. The high Arctic will become much wetter. Scientists are looking on more exact regional predictions. Even these models, Betts says, do not account for feedbacks or interacting feedbacks. At 16 minutes into the talk, he makes David Wasdell's point exactly. In particular, the carbon cycle, the way carbon moves from the sky into both the soil and the sea, is projected to stop working in the same way in a rapidly warming world. The soil, which holds far more carbon than the atmosphere, may become a net source of carbon instead of a sink or collector, as it currently is. And a drying Amazon would release gigatons of carbon as trees die or burn. Richard Betts says when these feedbacks are taken into account, we may reach 4 degrees centigrade of warming by 2070 or even 2060. That is 7 degrees Fahrenheit as a global average. Places like the southern United States would be unbearably hot for over 100 days a year. The summer sea ice in the Arctic would be a distant memory. Italy and Spain would be more like Saudi Arabia in heat and dryness. Agriculture would be severely damaged in a world expected to hit 9 billion people at that time. Tropical diseases spread north. Many species can't adapt and go extinct. A mass extinction. You get the picture. It's a disaster. As Wasdell said, until recently, scientists didn't study this terrible scenario because they naively assumed world governments would act to stop the wanton pollution of the atmosphere. Now there are at least 149 computer models running in various labs and on the net, struggling to catch up to the climate race. We can add the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, to that list. After previous conservative climate estimates, this year MIT doubled its projected heating to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, 5.2 degrees C, mean global warming by 2095. That paper was peer-reviewed and published in the American Meteorological Society Journal of Climate. You need to subscribe to view that, but in my blog, I've linked to Joe Rome's summary of that terrible news. And once again, as David Wasdell is warning us, even this bad estimate does not include the positive feedback loops operating in the Earth system. MIT study author Ronald Prin says, and I'm quoting here from Joe Rome and Prin, "And the odds indicated by this modeling may actually understate the problem, because the model does not fully incorporate other positive feedbacks that can occur. For example, if increased temperatures caused a large-scale melting of permafrost in Arctic regions and subsequent release of large quantities of methane, a very potent greenhouse gas, including that feedback is just going to make it worse," Prin says, end quote. Scientists haven't included feedbacks, and the piggybacking of one feedback on another, as David Wasdell was describing, because they just don't know how to model it yet. The Earth system is so complex, it is essentially unpredictable. But we know it can happen. It is already happening. None of the governments at Cancun Climate Conference know this. It is not in the 2007 IPCC report. The media can't communicate this story properly. Even you and I, slogging through these developments, can barely comprehend what this means. All we know is we don't know enough, but our current emissions are leading us to a climate disaster within this century, within the lifetimes of our younger listeners and our offspring. In a rare step, the Royal Academy has decided that the prospect of 4-degree warming is so important that, for a few days, they released the entire contents of their new theme issue on 4 degrees and beyond warming, and they let it out to the public. Now it's back behind a pay-per-view firewall. In the spirit of WikiLeaks and the need to tell the people what we face, I've uploaded all those papers as PDF files to our website. Make it your project. Read it for yourself. Find those links in my blog as well at ecoshock.info. Look for the title, Beyond the Tipping Point. I've also posted a paper by David Wasdell called Runaway Climate Change, Boundary Conditions and Implications for Policy, an interim report dated November 2010. So you can see the graphs and charts that should accompany our Radio EcoShock interview and his speech in Tallberg, Sweden. Get the audio from that key David Wasdell lecture, Beyond the Tipping Point, from the Climate 2010 page at ecoshock.org as a free MP3 download. Or watch the video of that speech. I've got a link to that in my blog as well. well. Be sure and read Joe Rome's blog on the Royal Academy papers with his headline, Royal Society Special Issue Details, quote, Hellish Vision, end quote, of 7 degrees Fahrenheit, 4 degrees C world, which we may face in the 2060s. Lots for you to do and learn, with all the links at ecoshock.info for this program titled Beyond the Tipping Point in December 2010. And why not? Only the future of the world is at stake. Is that worth your time and effort to know? I hope so. Each one of us needs to be like Johnny Appleseed, distributing this critical information as far and as fast as we can to avoid climate catastrophe. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for your time and for your commitment.